From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This is the ninth day of an air battle between Palestinians and Israelis, and both Prime Minister Netanyahu and Hamas, the militant group which governs the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, say they won't stop. Hamas began launching rockets after an incident with Israeli police at a sacred site in Jerusalem. But there's also simmering rage over eviction of Palestinians from the West Bank territory to make way for Jewish settlers. Yesterday, President Biden expressed support for both Israel's right to defend itself and for a ceasefire. But many Democrats, including Congressman Mark Pocan of Wisconsin, want stronger language and actions. He joins us by phone. And Congressman, have I got that right?
Well, what we want is to use the power of the United States in diplomacy to first get a ceasefire and second, work towards some lasting peace. You know, when I first came to Congress, I remember when Barack Obama had said no more illegal settlements. It's going to make it too hard to have a two-state solution. And yet all I've watched for 8.5 years is continued expansions, the removal of Palestinians from their homes. This isn't something that happened 10 days ago with Hamas firing rockets, which I all think we should condemn. But certainly years and decades of mistreatment of Palestinians has really led us to this point.
Let's take the notion of the settlements. Both Palestinians and Israelis make ancient claims to this land. As you know, it goes in and out of Israeli courts. Recently, there was this movement in the West Bank settlement. And here's a clip from a video that went viral. It shows Mona Al-Kurd, a young Palestinian, accusing a Jewish settler of taking her family home in occupied East Jerusalem. Let's listen.
It's easy to yell at me, but I didn't do this.
Yeah, you are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it.
No one.
You know, millions have seen this, Congressman. And behind this is this ancient debate over who owns the land. How do you resolve that?
Well, but there is official recognized lines that we're trying to get back to. I think what gets referred to the most often is going back to the late 60s, the lines you had then. If we're ever going to get to a two-state solution, there will be land swaps to get to some point. But if one side, who has the power and might, continues to take away the housing from the other side, that's never going to get us towards peace.
Well, but that's not what President Trump said. As you know, he officially declared Jerusalem the capital of Israel. He moved the U.S. embassy there, enraging people who have wanted East Jerusalem to be the capital of a Palestinian state and a two-state solution.
So first of all, Donald Trump was, a humanitarian anomaly. But what, you're right, because of that shift in policy, there is a bigger burden on Joe Biden. But Joe Biden's been pretty big and bold on a lot of things so far. And I think what he needs to do is bring us back to the point that we can help be brokers in peace. You know, the last time I was there, I remember looking into a valley and seeing a major road with a giant wall separating the middle where one side Palestinians can drive and one side Israelis can drive. That reminds too many of us of the former South Africa that took too many abuses of its people. We need to get back to that role to try to be brokers in peace.
Well, your colleague, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has described this as an apartheid state. You tweeted out over the weekend, Palestinians in Gaza live in an open-air prison while Israel keeps expanding illegal West Bank settlements. But do you think that there is a change in the air because of social media and the recent racial reckoning around the world? There are people who are trying to end-run governments and make this a human rights issue around the world in this moment.
Absolutely. And because of that, people can see for themselves what's happening on the ground. And when you kill 20 times the number of people that have been killed by Hamas rockets, people start questioning this, especially Gaza. You know, Gaza, a majority of the people are on food assistance. 98% of the water is undrinkable. Those conditions actually are creating the problem where you're going to have more people become radicalized. This is a powerful tool for those who do try to recruit people to be terrorists.
Well, Mark Perry, who's a senior analyst at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, is one of those who's saying that President Biden might have to do what no U.S. president has ever done and issue a statement, much like the U.S. said to Saudi Arabia, we support you, but it's not unconditional. On the other hand, there are people who say this is intractable and the U.S. is not going to be able to solve it if Israel won't negotiate and the Palestinians won't. Why is this a U.S. problem?
Because, one, we do take this role across the planet, especially in a region that's so important to many people in the United States. But also, we're supplying much of the assistance to Israel. You know, I personally support the Iron Dome because that is intended to de-escalate any violence.
The Iron Dome, this is the anti-missile craft system that Israel has that can knock down some of these rockets.
Exactly. But the intention is to de-escalate violence because you took it out, fewer people are killed on both sides. However, when Israel then goes and does what it's been doing for the last 9 days, that's the opposite of the goal of Iron Dome.
What do you say to those who say that Israel does have the right, as soon as rockets come in, to defend itself? And Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who says Democrats like you are making a false equivalence between terrorist aggressors — Hamas is considered a terrorist organization — and a responsible state defending itself.
Yeah, so I think we have to realize the two beneficiaries right now of what's going on are Benjamin Netanyahu and Hamas, not the people of Israel or Palestine. And that's the real problem. So, yes, they absolutely have to be able to defend themselves, but they have to show restraint. We're not seeing restraint right now by Netanyahu.
That's Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan of Wisconsin. Congressman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, here in Maricopa County, Arizona, top Republicans are calling out their own party's ongoing audit of the 2020 election results. The Republican State Senate is leading the recount in Arizona's largest county. They claim without proof that last year's election was inaccurate. But yesterday, the Republican chairman of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors said the audit must end. Here's Jack Sellers.
People's ballots and money are not make-believe. It's time to be done with this craziness and get on with our county's critical business.
Jen Fifield is a reporter for the Arizona Republican. Jen, why are top Republicans like Jack Sellers in Maricopa County starting to turn on this audit?
What's really happening is the tension between the county's Board of Supervisors and our Senate, which has commissioned this audit. The Board of Supervisors helped oversee this election. They all have said multiple times this was a fair election. There was no widespread fraud. They're tired of, they say, the tax on their employees, their election officials that ran this election. They're tired of correcting the record. They're tired of answering to the Senate's questions. So it's all just boiling over here.
And one of the tipping points, it sounds like, are some statements coming from the Senate President, Karen Fan, who said recently that the county had deleted files from a server before handing it over to the Senate for review. Could you fact check that? Is there any proof to that?
The county went through in detail the missing files that these auditors say that they've found and why they may be missing when the auditor tries to find them. It's not so much just the files were deleted. The county has said over and over again they don't delete election files. They archive some of them, and they might not have been in the database that they requested under the subpoena. But overall, when the county did a review of these supposed missing files that the auditors can't find, they said what probably happened is the auditors, unfamiliar with how the county stores its data, made a copy of the data in the wrong way, or maybe it was performing its own search wrong for the data. And so they put it back on the auditors and said, we gave you everything you asked for. It's up to you to figure out how to use it.
Hmm. So the statement was false, but it did start something of a brush fire, didn't it? The claim from Senate President Karen Fan was enough to get the former president, Donald Trump, involved. What did he say?
He put out a statement that said the entire county database was gone. This, of course, rubbed many people wrong who have been watching this audit, especially the county supervisors and the recorder. He put out a statement. This is Republican recorder Stephen Richer saying that the president's statement was unhinged, that these were insane lies, that they were as readily falsible as 2 + 2 = 5. So saying that whatever the president was saying was false.
So it's amazing that that's coming from Republicans in the state of Arizona. If it is the start of a revolt within the party against this audit, what does it mean for the count? And maybe more importantly, what does it mean for the party?
These are the same Republicans who actually have been quietly saying this the whole time since November 3rd. They're just getting a little louder now. They're really tired of hearing this. Now, in our state Senate, only one or two senators out of a Senate majority have spoke out against this audit. And that's what the supervisors were saying yesterday. They were calling on the senators to stand up to this. But what the overall feeling is that even if people do speak against it, like you asked, what does this mean for this audit? It doesn't seem like that might matter because there's private fundraising going into this audit from Republican sources across the country. So there's a lot of pressure to keep it going.
And it's been nearly a month since the counting began. It doesn't seem like they're anywhere close to being done. How much longer can we expect it to last?
This is going to last into the summer. Originally, they started on April 23rd, and they had planned to count all 2.1 million ballots by May 14th, by the time they had to exit the Coliseum here for graduations to take place. They got to about 500,000 ballots, and so now they're looking to come back after graduations and resume for what could be weeks or months.
Wow. Jen Fifield is a reporter for the Arizona Republic. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
If I mention the band, the Black Keys, you might hear something like this. I wanted love, I needed love, most of all, but on their new album, Delta Cream, the Black Keys are, as the song says, going down south. Here's their version of the R.L. Burnside classic. In fact, the entire album is an homage to the Mississippi Blues with covers from Burnside, David Jr. Kimbrough, and Mississippi Fred McDowell. Again, the album is Delta Cream, and joining me now are founding members of the Black Keys, Dan Auerbach and Patrick Carney. Welcome. It's great to speak with both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Dan, we read that Going Down South is one of your favorites. Why does it work for you?
Ooh, you know, we'd never tried to play that song before, and when we did, I tried to sing in the full voice like R.L. used to, but it didn't really work so well. So I just tried it with the falsetto and we just went for it. But, you know, that was one of the songs that I saw R.L. play when I was 18. You know, I saw him in Cleveland, Ohio, play with Kenny Brown on guitar and his grandson, Cedric. And it's always been one of my favorites of his.
Let's talk about, you know, your history with this music. The entire album is a nod to your roots as a band in Mississippi Hill Country Blues. But you got to explain that. How did a couple of guys from Akron get into music like that, Patrick?
Dan grew up listening to the blues through his uncle Tim and his dad. And the weird thing is that, you know, we grew up about a couple hundred feet from each other, but we were great apart. And independent of each other, we both kind of stumbled across R.L. Burnside. And our brothers kind of figured out that we were listening to the same dude, and we got together and started jamming. In 2001, I had this little kind of recording device. I was going to record Dan at a bar band. I was going to record them. The other guys he was playing with didn't show up. So it was just Dan and I hanging out. And Dan said, why don't you just go play drums? And we went down in the basement and we recorded five RL and Junior covers and made this demo. And we just formed a band right there on the spot. So, I mean, literally the band wouldn't exist if it weren't for these guys. And we've covered their music on the first couple records. But, you know, it seems like we kind of were due to pay a proper homage to these dudes.
But why now? Why make this album of Mississippi Blues in this?
Because everything we do is an accident, essentially. Like, the band formed accidentally, and then this record came about because we had just finished a huge arena tour. And we came back to Nashville, and Dan, you know, he has a record label called Easy Eye, and he's making a record for one of his artists, a singer named Robert Finley. And he decided to have Kenny Brown, who was R.L. Burnside's slide guitarist, come up, and Eric Deaton, a bass player who had played with Junior Kimbrough. So he was cutting this record with these guys, and he invited me to come to the studio to jam.
Let's get to another song on Delta Cream. It's called Crawling Kingsnake, a classic. Here's your take on it. Well, I'm a crawling kingsnake. To your window, crawl up on your door. I'd do anything.
we were definitely referencing Junior Kimbrough's version, which was so unique. And, you know, that's just the beautiful thing about American music, is it's the ultimate melting pot. And that's where all of the best music comes from, is when it starts to mix and get filtered by different regions. And that's the good stuff for us, you know. And Junior Kimbrough, he had his own sound, and it was so unique and so identifiable, and it couldn't have been from anywhere else but Northern Mississippi.
Is it true that you made this album over the course of 2 days with no rehearsals? Is that normal?
Yeah, so we were doing the session the day before, and I had Kenny Brown in the studio for the first time, and I was playing with Eric Deet, and I knew Pat would love it, so he came over, and we just started recording songs. I mean, we never talked about doing a record. We just kind of spent the afternoon jamming and playing. We had a percussionist there, Sam Bacco, and, you know, so Black Keys have never recorded with a percussion player. We've never recorded with a bass player. We'd never played with Kenny Brown. So it was this amazing combination of these old songs that we knew them so well, they're in our subconscious. We hadn't played them in years, but we're playing with all these new people. So it was like this brand new experience. It was really amazing.
But the two of you have been playing together for 20 years now, right? I mean, how has your relationship with each other changed over those years and your approach to the music?
I mean, we've grown up together. You know, we've learned how to do all this together. The band started accidentally, like I said, like September of 2001. And our whole goal was, like, we wanted to make a record. From there, you know, we went on to playing Madison Square Garden and headlining Coachella. And when Dan called me after we just came back from, you know, doing 35 arena dates, and he wanted me to come jam with Kenny Brown, it was like there was a no-brainer. It was like, this is exactly what we got into this for.
Are you still friends after all these years?
Absolutely. We've been through a lot. I spent more time with Dan than I have at this point with my parents, with any partner romantically. You know, we have spent a lot of time together. We've lasted longer than like Led Zeppelin and the Beatles combined. It's been a long time.
Pat, you're the drummer. Have you ever sang on a Black Keys album?
My first vocal appearance is at the very top of Delta Cream when I asked Dan if he's ready. I sing to my son, and that's the only time. I got an F in music in sixth grade. This is a true story.
Wow.
My music teacher, and I'm going to call her out by name, Mrs. Boys Green. She made me sing This Country Tis of Thee in front of the class, and I turned bright red, and she gave me an F in music.
Wow.
Yeah, and now I have 5 Grammys.
Wow.
Wow, never told me that.
Yeah.
Is that true? That's really why you don't sing?
Psycho.
It traumatized me to no end, and I love singing. I'm married to a great singer. I'm in a band with a great singer. I can do a pretty good version of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star at this point, but that's all I got.
Well, that's amazing. I'm sure if you haven't told that story before, your fans will love to hear it. Let's listen to another song. Here's your take on Junior Kimbrough's Stay All Night.
Stay all night. Stay a little long. Pull off your clothes and throw them in the cold. And love me, girl. Love me, baby. Love me, baby. Love me,
to ask you about the cover art on this album. It's very interesting. It's William Eggleston's photo of a little food shack with a sign, Delta Cream, on the front. Tell me about that picture. What had inspired you about it, and why are you using it with this album?
Eggleston has been Pat and I, our favorite photographer for years. You know, we both probably own all his books, and we're pretty much obsessed with him. And when we were thinking about an album cover, we're thinking about Eggleston, but we weren't sure that it would be possible, you know. But we reached out and we told him what the project was, and he was such a supporter of music, and especially Mississippi music. And this photograph was taken in northern Mississippi too, and so they granted our request and let us use a photograph, and it's like a dream come true. It's such an amazing thing to have one of his photos on the cover.
A cool story that Kenny Brown shared with us a couple weeks ago was Dan and I have been watching this black and white footage of R.L. Burnside playing solo electric guitar at a house party. We showed it to Kenny. He's like, you know what's crazy? He's like, that was filmed on Eggleston's camera. They borrowed it to shoot that, and he was there. That's the coolest thing about this record to me, is that we grew up listening to these guys, listening to this music, and Dan had me over to his studio because he had two of the makers here, and it gave me chills. It was like the same feeling I got the first time I heard Dan play. It's cool to find ourselves 20 years later in the exact same spot.
And now you're the heroes to the young musicians out there. The founders of the Black Keys, Dan Auerbach and Patrick Carney. The new album of Mississippi Blues Classics is called Delta Cream. Great to speak with you both. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And I want to leave you with another R.L. Burnside song. This is the Black Keys version of Poor Boy, A Long Way From Home. By the way, Dan and Pat mentioned blues musician Robert Finley. I actually interviewed Finley back in 2016 when he was making a recording debut at the age of 63. We've got that interview and more from the Black Keys at hereandnow.org.
I'm Yoe Shaw.
I'm Kia Miakonatis.
We're the hosts of the NPR podcast, Invisibilia.
You can think of Invisibilia kind of like a sonic blacklight.
When you switch us on, you will hear surprising and intimate stories.
Stories that help you notice things in your world that maybe you didn't see before.
Listen to the Invisibilia podcast from NPR.
Kids 5 and younger are not officially authorized to get a COVID-19 vaccination, but they are enrolled in early clinical trials. Leslie McClurg from member station KQED reports in the story that first aired on All Things Considered that widespread vaccinations for the 5 and under set could begin this fall.
3-year-old Eloise LaCour clutches her dolly as a Stanford University nurse takes her blood pressure.
Can you tell me what your name is?
My name is Eloise.
We'll use this arm, okay?
And then he swabs Eloise's delicate upper arm.
Tickle, okay. Yeah. Mommy's going to hug you, okay?
And carefully administers the vaccine.
Hey, how about that?
That's it.
Look at you, brave kid.
Gosh, you are the bravest.
Eloise barely flinches. In fact, it looks like she might be smiling under her mask. She just received the Pfizer vaccine, one of 144 little kids across the country in trials like this one. I checked in with her parents the next day.
She was fantastic.
Like, she's told us her arm doesn't hurt at all, so she's been great.
Both parents, Chris and Angelica, say they were nervous about enrolling their only daughter, but they see the experience as a way to give back.
We are so incredibly lucky and fortunate to have a healthy 3-year-old child, and we know that there's a lot of other families with kids with vulnerabilities. COVID is potentially life-threatening for those children, and so being part of making this a reality for those families is something that was really meaningful to us.
3 weeks pass, and then it's time for the second poke. This time, Eloise dresses up as Princess Merida from the Pixar movie Brave.
Here we go.
There you go.
You did so good. Yeah.
She squirms a little more this time, but still no tears. The next day, Eloise had a little soreness in her arm and...
She had a little bit of a headache last night, solved with a low dose of Tylenol, but otherwise running around, lots of energy.
The LaCour family is excited to start planning summer vacations. They're not alone.
We've had lots of families, and they have just been beating down a path to our doorstep, and we are talking about thousands of people.
Dr. Yvonne Maldonado is the pediatrician leading Stanford's contribution to the Phase 1 trial. She has 10 times more volunteers than she needs. Historically, it's much easier to recruit kids for studies during active disease outbreaks. COVID has killed more than 300 children across the country.
That actually represents one of the top 10 causes of death in children right now. And there have been thousands of children hospitalized.
But not everyone is so eager to vaccinate their kids. A recent survey from the Kaiser Family Foundation shows less than a third of parents say they'll get their little ones vaccinated right away. Hesitancy, especially early on, is not new. It existed way back in the early 1800s when the smallpox vaccine was developed.
What has happened more recently, though, is much more sophisticated.
Dr. Myron M. Levine is a pediatrician and vaccinologist at the University of Maryland. He says the key difference today is how information spreads. The internet and social media platforms provide a ripe environment for anti-vax sentiment.
It was not like this in the 70s or 80s, truly.
In the coming months, Levine hopes parents will be swayed by the data from early trials rather than misinformation. He says without vaccinating kids, it will be nearly impossible to stamp out COVID.
You have to have a very, very high level of coverage to keep that bad genie in the bottle.
Pfizer says it could be ready to distribute pediatric COVID shots as early as September. For NPR News, I'm Leslie McClurg in San Francisco.
If you've been stuck at home during the pandemic, have you found yourself winnowing through closets? Wearing the same yoga pants for a year really focuses the mind on how little clothing we actually need. The amount of clothes Americans throw away every year has doubled in the last 20 years, from 7 million to 14 million tons, according to the EPA. And it's overflowing already overstuffed landfills. So now fashion brands like Adif, get it, a difference, are developing new ways to reduce textile waste by recycling, or as it's called, upcycling used clothing. And Adif has recipes for how to do that. Truly, their book is the open source fashion cookbook. We'll have tons of pictures at hereandnow.org, recipes or directions for everything from a shirt dress made of a couple of button downs to a collapsed umbrella turned into a hat. We want to bring in co-founder Angela Luna. She's in New York. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. And Lowell Assad is in Amman, Jordan. Lowell, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Robin.
And Angela, I should have said to you, welcome back, because we spoke in 2016. At that time, you were a senior at the Parsons School of Design, and you'd created a coat that could be turned into a tent for a displaced person or a homeless person. And we understand that's now a centerpiece in your company. So congratulations. But it just underscores what we're talking about. You've long thought that fashion should be socially responsible.
Yeah, I mean, I originally started Adif with this general idea that fashion can do more. Since 2016, my goal has just been evolving that idea and transitioning that from just, you know, a jacket that can turn into a tent into really questioning the entire fashion industry as a whole and how we can actually put solutions into practice.
And also, Angela, it's a reminder about this pandemic to students and people everywhere. If you're bored and you have an idea, it could grow into a great thing during a time like this, which is what happened with your cookbook. Talk about that.
Exactly. So we were spending pretty much our entire lives at home just sort of reflecting on the position of the fashion industry. And with everything that was going on in the U.S., you know, watching and participating in the social justice movements nationwide, we started to really sort of question fashion's role in every sort of aspect in the world, especially as it related to systemic racism. So we were thinking about ways that we could make sustainable fashion more accessible to people. I know, like everyone else, you know, my restaurant bill was cut down almost entirely when the pandemic happened because I started cooking from home. And I realized, wow, you know, not only is this healthier for me, but it's also healthier for my wallet. And I thought, well, you know, why can't fashion sort of be that same way? Generally, fast fashion is, you know, bad for the planet, bad for people, bad for everything.
By fast fashion, this is this notion that cheaply made clothing, which is far more affordable for people, they can, you know, wear it and then toss it. But that's really bad for the environment.
Exactly. No, it is incredibly harmful because these pieces generally only last, you know, 1 to 2 wears. And it's similar. We would compare fast fashion to sort of fast food. Sort of thinking about that idea, you know, my professors always said, if you're good at design, you're probably a good cook as well. If you wanted to learn how to cook, you know, you go to a cookbook or you look up some recipes online. why can't that be applied to fashion? And how can we educate people on how to care for their clothes better, mend their clothes, and actually create things themselves so they no longer have to rely on the existing fashion system?
Well, Lulwa, there in Jordan, where you're visiting family, tell me about this concept of having designers actually contribute to this cookbook. Design is so proprietary. That's why something's called a knockoff. You know, when you make something that looks like a high-end design, you got designers to actually contribute and tell people how to do it.
Yeah, so the reason we asked designers to contribute is because we envision this as a comprehensive industrial shift, so it cannot just end with us. And we actually got a great response from most of the designers who we reached out to. And we feel like this is, you know, the best way to create impact in the industry if we all collectively work together.
Yeah. I am looking at a picture of a plastic hoodie, a lovely plastic hoodie around a model's head, which also drops down and has pockets, kind of like a vest. What is that? Is that a shower curtain?
That is a shower curtain, yes. So in designing the pieces for the cookbook, we were trying to think in creating garments, what could we use or what could people use within their own homes that they could upcycle to create something new that wouldn't cause them to rely on traditional, you know, fashion supply stores. So we're looking at materials like, you know, T-shirts, jeans, blankets, bed sheets, shower curtains, broken umbrellas that they might traditionally throw away after a few uses. So shower curtains were one of those. And this is sort of, yeah, like it's our system pocket. So this is one of the applications of that. This is a chest harness that also has a waterproof hood that's made from a shower curtain.
And when you say upcycle, Lua, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so we define upcycling as the use of existing materials, often materials to be discarded to create new items. So this means that you're not going to the fabric store to buy brand new fabric that was produced as a textile at a textile mill, but leveraging existing things as the raw material to create something new. So the concept of making your own garments isn't novel, like until the introduction of fast fashion. So like creating your own clothing was customary. Like we can all just ask our grandmas.
Yeah, people used to like darn their socks. They'd like sew up holes in things. They would constantly work on their clothing to get every single second out of it.
Exactly.
And clothing was cherished too back then, like back when people would darn their socks. People had a great sense of respect for their clothing and would keep it for years.
Okay, I'm going to ask each of you. Angela, you start. Just which one of your favorite designs in the book, and what does it use?
I will say one of my favorite pieces in the book is actually the blanket jacket. This jacket was just used from two woven blankets that I happen to have laying around my apartment. But honestly, I wear this jacket out in the city all the time. And I tell you, I've never gotten so many compliments on a piece in my life.
Yeah. Lulwa?
My favorite piece, I would say, is the assembly shirt dress. The two button-down shirts. Just because it's the easiest item to create in this entire book, it requires no sewing. But other than that, this dress can be made using these like two dress shirts as a way to provide, you know, a new look to an old classic.
And who doesn't have old button-down Oxford shirts in the back of their closet?
Exactly, exactly. Everyone
especially
does.
Ones that are too large.
Yeah, right. Listen, just before we let you go, what further advice, just maybe one thought from each of you, do you have for consumers, just as they shop, how to be more sustainable and how to think of questions to ask? Angela?
Well, in writing this book, we really wanted to provide an educational tool for the customer to actually understand what questions they should be asking of their brands. You know, trying to provide a little bit more insight into what goes on, I like to say, behind the seams of the garment. Where it's being made, who is making it, how much those people are getting paid. My main point would just be to start to understand the time and the effort and the materials that actually go into producing garments.
And Lulwa?
So for us, what we did in this cookbook is we wanted to have a 360 approach in order to educate the customer. So we asked different thought leaders and academics in the sustainable fashion space to submit essays on sustainability, ethics, and inclusivity in the industry. For example, Sophia Lee's essay, who's a journalist, touches on the consumer perspective and talks about shopping consciously and how shopping from sustainable brands is actually not the only answer. But what we actually need to be doing is shopping less and using what we already have, taking a cue from all these traditional practices, such as mending and repairing and so on.
And again, what fun to put together one of these outfits. From Adif co-founders Angela Luna and Lawa Al-Saad, their book is The Open Source Fashion Cookbook, recipes for making your own clothing out of clothing you already have. We'll have links and everything at herenow.org. Angela, again, congratulations. And Alua, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Thank you, Robin.
And again, their self-published open source fashion cookbook is available on Amazon. The authors say, yes, a big cut goes to Amazon, but a percentage goes to those designers who gave their work and some to Adif. Pictures at herenow.org. And what I love is the models. That look that says, yes, I'm wearing what appears to be a rubber dinghy. You have a problem with that? It's at hereandnow.org.
The sound of Palestinian rockets fired from Gaza intercepted in the skies over Israel. The country's defense system, known as the Iron Dome, has been effective at preventing most rockets from hitting their targets. It is getting more attention now in this latest wave of violence, but Iron Dome was first deployed in 2011 and was funded partly by the U.S. government. Aaron Stein is here to help us understand how it works. He's director of research at the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia. Aaron, welcome. It's great to speak with you.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And what exactly is the Iron Dome? How would you describe it?
It's a system developed to defend against short-range rockets, the types of rockets that are particularly present in both the Palestinian territories as well as in southern Lebanon and used by both groups of Hamas and Hezbollah. It's the last line of defense. You know, as in any type of effort to try and intercept missiles or rockets, the hope is that you get them on the ground before they launch. But if you miss them, and in the particular case of the Gaza war right now, these are very difficult to find on the ground. They're the last line of defense before they impact on Israeli territory.
And when a rocket is fired at Israel, how does the Iron Dome react, acknowledge it, and stop that rocket from landing?
Well, it gets picked up on radar, and then the interceptor is fired at the incoming salvo. And then the interceptor gets within as close as it can to one of the incoming rockets it chooses to intercept and has a proximity fuse that then explodes, and then the shrapnel from the small warhead on top of the interceptor destroys the incoming rocket.
The Israel Defense Forces are saying that the Iron Dome has intercepted 90% of those rockets from Hamas. Is that an accurate number?
I mean, it's hard to tell. What is certainly the case is that we can see before the Iron Dome was deployed and after the Iron Dome was deployed. And before the Iron Dome was deployed, these rockets were falling on Israeli territory in far more frequency than they are now. When they use that 90% number, we don't know if that's 90% intercepted or it is 90% of those that the system deems to be falling into a place where it could threaten lives and then ultimately chooses to try and intercept it.
What can't the Iron Dome intercept?
It's really what it's doing is intercepting these small rockets that are unguided. For larger things, Israel has other systems, whether it be Patriot, the U.S.-made system, and for even the larger class missile systems, it has the Arrow. Now, I want to say, that even at that 90% number, a lot still squeak through, and that becomes a political problem, obviously, for the Israelis, as well as a security problem, because people are injured and people are killed. But because they are so small, because they are mobile, because these things can be fired off the back of trucks on timers, is that they're very difficult to find. And that's ultimately why this is such a difficult problem, both from a before they are launched and after they are launched things to deal with.
One of the reasons they're also sneaking through is because Hamas is firing thousands of rockets over a short period of time, far more already than during the entire war in 2014. Have you seen a significant change in Hamas's strategy to try to get around the Iron Dome?
They're trying to salvo fire. I mean, they're trying to saturate it in so that, like, if you fire enough, some will get through. And that is working. The other thing is that, you know, these small rockets that Hamas fires, they can make indigenous in the Palestinian territories and in Gaza. And you have to think of them as essentially infinite, right? They don't cost a lot to make. You can make them very quickly, and it doesn't take a genius to lob them over at Israel. Whereas the Iron Dome interceptor costs somewhere in the range of about $40,000 per shot. What the Israelis do to increase the cost, they launch punitive and coercive airstrikes on Hamas infrastructure targets. They obviously, this overlaps a lot with civilian infrastructure targets. And so it tries to exact a broader political cost on the group for the firing of rockets. But I do think that what we're seeing here, obviously, is these very old, these very sort of crude rockets are the face of modern warfare, which is that a non-state or quasi-state actor, in the case of Hamas, can produce these at scale and can then fire them in mass at the Israelis, even though the Israelis have considerable tactical overmatch and considerable augmented capabilities to try and stop them.
I want to get your take on a recent Washington Post op-ed that argued the Iron Dome has reduced the pressure on Israel to do much to resolve this conflict because Israel can just protect itself from these rockets without engaging Hamas in a ceasefire or a ground war. Do you think that the Iron Dome has changed the strategic balance for Israel and in some ways made the conflict even more drawn out?
No. I mean, I read the op-ed. This conflict is intractable because neither side actually wants to solve it. It's not intractable because the Israelis invented a fancy missile to intercept rockets. It may lessen the political cost on Israeli leaders, but if you were to just follow the conflict over the past week or so, enough are squeaking through, that you still have rockets falling on Israeli cities. I mean, we have seen Israeli civilians getting hurt or getting injured or killed, and so I don't see the Iron Dome as anything other than sort of a technical solution to a technical problem.
Aaron Stein is director of research at the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia. Thank you for these insights. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.